we begin with prayer. Father, thank you so much for this beautiful, sunshiny day. Thank you more than anything that we know that your presence is here, that you never abandon us, you never leave us, and that you continue to mold us despite how long it takes, despite how often we reject your molding. We thank you that you continue and that you are faithful. We pray today that we would hear your spirit speak to us, that your words would be spoken clearly, and that we would be in awe of the work that you have done in us already, that you are continuing to do, and the purpose that you have for us. May we be thrilled at that purpose. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
All right, good morning, good morning. Let's see here. Here we go. So we are beginning with Genesis 16 through 22, and I will tell you, I shouldn't tell you how many pages of notes I have, should I?
No. We don't have anything to compare it to. It's
a super long lesson. So all that to say, I probably will go over. I probably will not get to Isaac's sacrifice. I will probably put that into next week. I have it here just in case things go really quick. But I know that that's unlikely. So just so I'm just going to warn you there. And because of that, we're going to zip right into it. Begin the lesson there. And before I forget, those of you out there on Facebook, I'm going to ask you, have you walked with God this week? We always ask in the class whether we have. So hopefully you guys are asking yourselves that as well. So the trust mold. We've been talking about Abraham. It's his story about him being molded from fear to trust. So we need to talk a little bit more about trust, really what it is and why God wants us to trust. So this is my own definition of trust. This isn't Webster's definition, but I think this is a kind of a good handle on it. When we talk about trust, what we mean is being able to put our confidence in someone that they have our back, right? That's what trust really is. But we need to also talk about who we trust. I think all of us understand that we mostly trust those whom we're in relationship with, right? We don't just trust strangers. We trust those who we're in relationship with. But sometimes we come across a situation where there is no one that we're in relationship with, and we need to trust someone else. What then makes us choose whom we trust in a situation where we don't have a prior relationship? So I want you to put yourself in a situation that's pretty scary, a situation that you don't know what to do and you're going to have to depend on someone else. And there are three people that are there willing to help. Now I'm going to describe those three people and you decide which one you're going to choose. So the first one is a person that is actually from your neighborhood. They go to your same church. The spouse works with someone that you love. The second person is a person from a foreign country that you have know nothing about. He lives in a much wealthier community than you do. You know nothing about his religious affiliation, but you do know that he owns a multi-billion dollar company. The third person that is willing to help is a person who's often without a permanent home. They don't have any means of support, and they're often in need. Which one of those three is your first response to, who's going to help me?
First one,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The fact is, we mostly trust people who are like us.
Right.
Why do we trust people who are like us? Because our fear moves us there. It's a natural movement of disordered fear to protect ourselves. To protect ourselves from being hurt. To protect ourselves from being left without protection of our body, or our thinking, or our emotions, or our relations. Which means we'll move away from unknown. We'll avoid the things we don't know, the places we don't know, the people we don't know, because we feel there we'll be vulnerable. Vulnerable means to be open to being wounded. So we will move away from the unknown places and we will move toward those who are most like us. It's an understandable fear, right? From a human point of view, no one desires to be hurt. Which means when we're dealing with that issue of fear of the unknown, fear of the other, we need to have compassion, recognizing it as a commonality between all of us. That's a normal thing for someone who just lives in this world. We will actually go toward those who are like us. That's always a sign of being fearful of the other, the unknown. We don't know about them, and we would rather be with someone of our own. Think about the friends that you make. Your initial response is to make friends who are like you. Actually, when you are hurt and you want someone to be there with you to comfort you, you want someone who's going to agree with you, right? Mm-hmm. Even if your hurt was like necessary, mm-hmm. you want someone to say, oh, that was horrible, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. We want that because that makes us feel like we're loved that way. So God desires for us to trust. That's what he's been doing with Abraham. He has been molding him to trust him. But God himself has two obstacles. The first is, there is no prior relationship, right? So now all of us, Abraham included, are in this position of somebody wanting to trust us to trust him, whom we had no prior relationship with. But the second is, God is not like us. He is an other, right? He is true otherness. And his otherness doesn't merely speak to his geography or his job title or his experiences or his even beliefs, but of an unchangeable essence. The fact is, it is harder for me to acquire, what constitutes you, the more other you are, right? Do you know what I'm saying by that? Mm-hmm. So the harder it is for me, so those three people I gave as examples, that person who lives in a wealthier community than myself, okay, so they're not very much like me, but I could acquire that eventually. So they're a little bit easier. The other person who has no home, no means of support, is often in need. I could actually end up there, but I don't ever want to believe I could end up there. So that seems even farther away, right? So if you had ranked them, it would have been the one that is most like me first, the one that whom I could become, and the third one whom I could never possibly become, right? So for God, God is way other. His essence says, I can never become you. So he is even more other than anybody else. Otherness for all of us instills fear. Think about you finding a weird creature, even a creature that you know of, but you don't really have a lot of experience with. In the summer, there was a big, gigantic, I think it was a toad. I really don't know the difference between a frog and a toad when I look at them. And he was just sitting there like he was dead. And I wanted to know if he was dead. He was underneath our picnic table where we eat. So I'm like, I want to know if he's dead. What do you think I did?
I poked him.
But what happens when I poke? I poke and then I go away, yeah. right? That's what happens. I might poke at a strange creature, but because I don't know how it's going to react, I poke and then I withdraw, right? That's exactly what we do with an other, with something strange, with something we don't know. That is the paradigm of the Babel world, right? They have moved so far away from God as the center of order. They've moved so far away from God. He is completely another creature. They have no idea who he is. They're so distanced from knowing him. He is complete other. And rather than risking coming near, they don't even want to poke him anymore. Like two other. What do? They make their own God. They make a God who is like them. Oh yeah, that's much more comfortable. That will allay my fears. I don't have to fear that he will have my back or not, because he's like me and I know me, right? So rather than risking coming near, rather than drawing near to an other, they construct their own God who is like them. So there's no need to fear, because if he's like them, they know that they have his back. They're going to sacrifice to him. They're going to make his little bed up there on the ziggurat. No problem. They'll do that for him. And because they know who they are, they assume the same of him if they've made him in their image. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. The more you're like me, the more I can trust you, because I know what I would do in that situation. And so I assume you'd do the same thing, right? So it's a protective move to insulate from the possibility of being hurt. our thoughts on trust are based on being like one another. I'm pretty confident that you'll have my back when you and I are alike, because I know I would have your back. Trust in that case is actually an information-driven statistical knowledge of what you would do based on similarities with me. So in truth, it's not really trust, is it? But that's how we see trust. That's actually how we live trust. We know, well, Cindy and I are a lot alike, so I know I can trust her. And here's a really good example. We all are pretty similar. We come from, you know, similar backgrounds. We have things like that. But I have something in common with Cindy and not the rest of you. When something happens to, when I have voles in my yard and I'm all upset about the voles and I don't know what to do, I'm not going to call any of you, but I'll call Cindy. And she will commiserate with me. And she will say, here's what I did. We have that in common, so I want to go to her. Does that make sense? I trust what she says. So that it is deep within us that our trust is actually a statistical knowledge. That's what we consider trust.
That's why we get on planes with pilots we don't know, right?
Right, because there's a statistical knowledge of these work 85% of the time.
Yeah.
Whatever. Actually, it's actually a higher percentage.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah.
So if God's wanting us to trust him, but he has two obstacles. We don't know him. We have no prior relationship with him, and he's not like us. He's going to need to overcome those obstacles. And so what he does, as we've seen with Abraham in the first lesson, is he begins to draw us near him through the provocation of fear. Well, that's a weird way to draw us, isn't it? Through the provocation of fear. What he's doing is highlighting that that's what we're feeling. He's making us know this is why we don't want to draw near. He provokes that, helping us to know that fear is the opposite of trust. I'm afraid because I don't believe someone has my back. I don't believe someone is there willing or able to protect me. And then in the midst of that fear, what God does is he offers belonging through an experience of his trustworthiness. I want you to think of it this way. I don't know if when you were a little kid, if one or more, probably your dad, played monster with you. So this was a big deal in our house, and Bill played monster with the kids. And of course, because we have kind of a loop, run around, and you know, the kids were scared, right? So they'd run away from him. But he would turn around, right, and meet them as they were running, and they would run right into him. And then of course he would hug them and tell him, I'm not a monster, basically, right? That's the idea God is doing. He's making us run and then running the other way and meeting us right there. But you belong to me. Yeah, you ran away from me, but you can run right into me and see that I actually am someone who can comfort you. That's the kind of idea of God provoking our fear so that we run and are afraid, and then he shows up as the place of comfort. So that in the midst of our fear, he offers belonging through an experience of trustworthiness, him wrapping his arms around us and picking us up. I'm going to show you that I have your back even before you commit to relationship with me. Even in the midst of you running away from me, I'm going to show you that I'm trustworthy. We saw that with Abram and Sarai as God led them and protected them and provided for them in Genesis 12 through 15. That counters then the disordered fear, the running away from. Yes, you were fearful of my otherness, God says, that I wouldn't have your back. But now you have some experience that despite my otherness, I am for you. You were the monster that made me afraid, and then there you were, despite the fact that you were the one who provoked my fear, there you were. And not only despite my otherness was I for you, because of my otherness, I was able to do for you what you could not do for yourself. So the otherness is actually an asset. Otherness gives the person something they couldn't have gotten on their own. So, why does God want us to trust? Well, we've already talked about this. He wants us to become whole. He wants us to be able to live in reality with Him. He wants our vocation to be able to be fulfilled. He wants us to be able to be the ones who reveal reality to the world, drawing others to trust the other God. And He wants our character to grow, to be like Him. So trust, when we talk about Abraham growing into trust, is trust itself is not a full character trait. It's like calling oneself a baker because you went to a baking school. Or calling yourself a pianist because you took lessons. Yes, you learned about playing the piano, but are you playing the piano? Are you actually, is that a consistent thing in your life? Can you be called a pianist because of that? Can you be called a baker because of that? So that trust is the learning to take it in, but you must expand it to being who you are so that people can trust you. In other words, in order for us to reveal that God is worthy of trusting, we need to be trustworthy to the world, to the other. And so when we look at, we have our trust letter up here, what we really need to do is God doesn't just bring Abraham and Sarah from fear to trusting Him. He wants to go farther. And so this week, we're going to see that He adds to that trust, molding them to be trustworthy. So it's a double T, right? So we have, yes, they've learned to trust God, but now He's going to mold them so that they are trustworthy to the world, to the other. The world is considered other, right? Because they're not participating yet in the life of God, in that perichoretic life. They're unable to make themselves actually one with God by either their desire or their will or their work. Even if they think they are, they haven't yet. And so what God wants for our character growth is that the other, the world, experiences someone who is other as having their back. God wants the world to experience that someone who is an other has their back. Someone is trustworthy, even though they have no relationship with them, even though they are other. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
So when we go to Africa for small children.
Yes.
They don't know us.
They don't know us, right? And so we've got to show them we're trustworthy without a relationship and despite what they are or do with us. Okay, so that's what God is molding in Abraham and Sarah and in us, that we are trustworthy to the other. So where does God begin molding trustworthiness? He will always begin in marriage. Marriage is the proving ground because it is the essence of trusting the other. Male and female. This is why Genesis 1 starts this way. I have created them male and female, the essence of which the other can never achieve. Despite the fact that we now know how to physically alter the body to look like something different, we can never become the other. A female cannot become a male. Yes, in body, right now our science can do that. But God says the essence of a male and a female are other. You're always going to be other. It's why the blessings of God begin with the power to create secure community between a male and a female. He made them male and female, and He blessed them as male and female to come together in secure community. It's also why after they sinned, He gives both of them remember, it's not a curse. He gives them a consequence that actually makes sure that they stay together. After they sin, they don't want to be in together, right? They hide from one another. And so what does He say to Eve? He says, I will make sure that you desire your husband. Mm-hmm. And husband, I will make sure you desire to rule, to bring order to your family. You will desire children so that that overcomes the fear of being with the other. So he ensures that in marriage. It's also why Jesus uses the picture of a man and a woman in relationship, husband and wife, as a picture of our relationship with God. It's two others in relationship. It's not just two individuals. It's not just two entities. It is two others becoming one. Because that all has to go back to trust. Trust is the foundation. But trust means I'm trusting the other, despite their otherness and because of their otherness, because they are able to give me something I don't have. Marriage not only is the proving ground, but marriage will test the motivation of the relationship. Trustworthiness is the ability to have someone's back purely for their benefit. If I have your back only because it will get me something, whether a tangible possession or it gives me emotional satisfaction or relational encouragement, it's not trustworthiness. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
In marriage, when there has been a commitment made to be trustworthy, and I wanted to bring up Elizabeth's wedding vows because there was something in there that they both said, I'm going to be there for you no matter what. That trustworthiness, that commitment, sometimes one partner fails. They fail to be trustworthy. And that's the test. Will the other partner continue to be trustworthy even when the other has failed? Because that says, I'm not in it so that you have my back. I'm in it for the relationship. I'm not in it for the benefits. I'm in it for the relationship. Do you understand why this is such an important issue? I mean, it is where we are in society today, right? We think, well, if I don't have the benefits that I expected when I went into marriage, then why not give up on it? But that's the whole point, right? Trustworthiness is I'm going to have your back no matter what, whether I get something out of this or not. And that enables us to rule. It enables us to bring order to the world from within a secure community. If I'm not trustworthy in a marriage partnership, I can't invite others to trust the greatest other. Oh yes, trust God. Yeah, I trusted God, but I'm not trustworthy because I don't stay in my marriage. That is a weird thing to offer, right? How can I offer what I actually don't cause to mold my character? And for the church, the trustworthiness from which we can bring reality to the world is modeled in our relationships with one another. We'll talk a little bit about that later. But it doesn't leave out those of us who are not married yet. We still have that relationship within the church, that we show oneself trustworthy with one another within the church, even if and when you've been hurt. We are able to do that. That is what we're bringing to the world. If we don't bring that, all the other things we bring to the world that we think are the gospel have nothing to stand on. Trust is the basis of relationship with the other. And that's who we're actually inviting, right? We're inviting them to have a relationship with the other God. So all of that is kind of a precursor to how we get here to chapter 16 and on. So we're going to look at the trust mold for Abraham's family. It begins with a marriage context. So even Genesis 11, when Abraham is introduced to the reader, we notice he's introduced with his wife. And even for A&E pagan society, husband and wife were considered one. So what happened to the husband happens to the wife. Right? So the call of Abram is not just to Abram. Because if it was, he would have said, leave your wife. But that would have been odd because that's not what marriage is. So when he calls Abram, he calls Sarai as well. And so we know that Sarai is included in the call and thus in the molding that he does to Abram. In fact, scripture will show us some of Sarai's molding. We'll see that today. It doesn't show us a lot of it. It assumes you know that that she is being molded alongside Abram. So we'll kind of see some of that. It's the same thing that when Adam was called to keep the garden, he was called with Eve, right? She was the helper. He also was her helper. They were helpers together. That's why he says, I created them. Male and female did I create them. They are one, and they are actually where I begin the molding. The importance of marriage is affirmed all the way through Genesis, but particularly in Abraham's story, throughout by God, if not by the humans. God protects Sarah and Abraham's marriage in Egypt. We saw that last week. He will this week protect their marriage when they're in Gerar. He will protect even Lot's wife because of Lot. He will protect her as they come out of Sodom. God protects. She walks away from the protection. So what we see is that God is affirming this partnership because it is the basis for us learning trustworthiness in partnership. So the blessings, the blessing bearers, Abraham's family, must be molded to be trustworthy with each other. And that's what we're going to see here. And I bet that you've never really thought about that with Abraham's story, but it's essential. It's essential not only to understanding Abraham's story, our story, and the individual stories that are in here. So Abraham and Sarah will be given the opportunity to learn how to be trustworthy with one another. And sometimes they're going to fail. They're going to be given the opportunities to be reminded of what it is to be a trustworthy partner. And they're going to be reminded from very unexpected sources. They will also be able to see a contrast, what it looks like when you aren't in a trustworthy relationship, a trustworthy partnership, where without that trustworthy partnership, there's little to no impact on the culture. They'll also have opportunities to practice trustworthy partnership in several ways. One of the things that a trustworthy partnership does is tells the truth. Tells the truth to one another, whether or not it might cause a little bit of discomfort, right? So this is order. Yes, this is not order. Even if it's going to cause a little problems, a trustworthy relationship will do that. A trustworthy relationship will do the best thing for the relationship. Even in the face of another's failure, it is not for individual benefit that trustworthy partnerships act. And what we will see is a connection with the other in trustworthy partnership in several places. We'll see between husband and wife. We'll see the possibility of it being between master and servant, between a countryman and a resident alien, and between God and his human family. So we're going to see all of that in 16 through 22. So the rest is the molding opportunities to make Sarah and Abraham a family of trustworthy partners. And what I've shrunk it down to, there's this pattern that we talked about last week, but I've shrunk it down so that it's just not so cumbersome because there's so many stories here. We have seven stories that we're going to look at. We're going to look at basically God provoking the fear. Remember, the monster running, so that he switches over on the other side and he holds out belonging. So it's the provoking of fear, the offering of belonging. Those are the two things we're going to see as we look at these stories. So starting with 16, we're going to see the story of Hagar and how Hagar gets into the mix of this thing. We see that God provokes fear. And the first fear that we see provoked is Sarah's, right? Sarai, and I'm sorry, I go between Sarai and Sarah. Right now she's Sarai. In a little bit she'll be Sarah. And then I won't have to worry about it anymore. She has no children. She has a fear of humiliation. Now, how do I know that? Well, first of all, because I know the culture. The society of values say a woman without children is of less value than those with children. They also look at someone without children as having no favor with the gods. And not just no favor, but actually that they're being punished by the gods. So they are considered accursed. They could be divorced because they have no children. And if they're divorced, they would be given their dowry back, but they would now be considered damaged goods. Who's going to want them now? They're accursed. And so they have no further means of support. That dowry is for the first month, and then they're out of it. And because Annie works under the RP, remember the retribution principle, since you have no children, you must have done something wrong. And it must have been having to do with having children, which means most likely you've been indecent sexually. That's what they would assume.
Wow.
So it's a huge curse, right, to not have children. You can understand then the humiliation of Sarai at this point. Now, we know that Sarai has some relationship with God because, first of all, she calls him Yahweh. So you need to assume she has been being molded with Abram all the while. She calls him Yahweh. She credits him with having control over her fruitfulness. So not another a god of fertility, but Yahweh himself. And she is concerned that God's promises are fulfilled. Now remember, up till now, the promise is just, Abram, you will have descendants. Doesn't say anything about Sarai.
Right.
But she knows God is going to fulfill that somehow through her husband. So her humiliation is all here. So fear of humiliation moves her, and it moves her to a socially sanctioned protective scheme, right? Mm-hmm. I will give my maid as a surrogate. Now, in Annie culture, that was actually something she should have done. It was something that was prescribed. They found in many of the texts that they have found that if a wife is barren, she should provide her husband with a surrogate childbearer. So to Sarai, this is a logical place to go. This is a logical place to run with her fear, because it's a normal Annie paradigm. So it doesn't register to her that it's not a trustworthy movement, that she is not trusting God. It doesn't even occur to her. So that's Sarai's fear. Abram's fear is actually the same. Even though Sarai is the one to suggest the scheme, she's actually, by culture, supposed to be the one to suggest the scheme. Abram is also fear-inspired. He also, though, doesn't know that. He buys into the cultural protective scheme without even thinking that it's a trust issue. So how do we know it is a trust issue? Because of how the author mentions it. He says, Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. And if you've been thinking about all of Genesis, what does that echo? Exactly. That's what God says to Adam. Because you listen to the voice of your wife. Remember, echoes are always very important in Scripture. And the author is saying to you, this is a matter of trust here. They are not trusting God. Now, Abram hasn't been told that his son is going to come through Sarai. So the issue isn't, I'm going to take one and do it myself. The issue is, I'm not going to wait until God tells me what to do. God hasn't told him, take a surrogate wife. So Abram's non-trust is, I'm not waiting to hear from God. I've not asked God or waiting. Well, we don't know if he's asked, but he's certainly not waiting for God to tell him what to do about this, because God wouldn't have told him to take Hagar. And so it is a matter of trust.
Well, I think he's mentioned it to God a couple of times, that he doesn't have an heir. And,
yep.
You know, so that
he's definitely
throwing it out there.
But as with us,
doesn't answer right away.
Right, and what do we do? Like Chris said, I'm going to tell you, God, what you should do. Oh, yeah. Well, you promised this, so I'll make sure it happens. Mm-hmm. So again, it is a matter of lack of trust on both Sarai and Abram's part. But the function of their relationship is where they need to be molded into trustworthy relationship. Trustworthy relationship is supposed to help the other. And it's supposed to help the other know they belong and to be able to fulfill their purpose. So often when we're distracted from the trustworthiness of a member of our partnership, we tend to move toward the noise, the voices that offer solutions to our fear, right? My partner isn't telling me I belong in one way or another, so I'm going to move toward voices that say I do belong, which is often what happens in a marriage that falls apart, right? Mm-hmm. One person doesn't feel like they're being told they belong, mm-hmm. and there are other voices that say, oh, you're wonderful. You belong with me. And so they move toward the voices. One or the other of Abram or Sarai should have been a helper. They should have said, has God told us? What does God want here? They should have pulled the others back from their plastic reality. They should have the plastic reality, remember the false reality, realities we construct out of our fear. They should have been able to say one to the other, this is not order. This is not what God is calling us to. Maybe he'll call us to that, but he hasn't yet. And it begs the question, what do we do when we live in a culture that diminishes not only God's order, but those helpers who attempt to pull us back to God's order? We usually say, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. Well, that was then, this is now. We castigate them. We call them names. We oppress them. We might even violently separate from them. What do we do when the church, who is the helper, capitulates to disorder and refuses to support the call back to God's order? Those are all rhetorical questions. I ask those because we need to keep on pressing into these, recognize we do the same thing as Sarai and Abram. We do it in our own lives, but we also do it within the church. And neither Sarai or Abram right here are acting as trustworthy partners. They're not calling the other back to order. They're going toward a cultural paradigm that says, oh yeah, you can do this. This is a good way to solve the infertility issue. For Sarai, if Abram was able and willing to call her back to order, that calling back to order wouldn't have been trying to make Sarai feel good. It's not about making her feel good. It's actually about affirming her belongingness despite the fact that her desires aren't being met. Yes, you feel this way. You feel horrible that you don't have children, but it doesn't mean you don't belong. That was Abram's job. You belong despite the fact that you feel differently. You still belong, and I'm going to pull you back. Doing so gives space then for God to work, to mold and shape not just Sarai, but Abram as well. So the issue is a molding for both of them. If I can meet my own needs by manipulating God's order, I don't have any space for God to work. I don't give him space. And I don't give my partner, whether it be a marriage partnership or within the church, I don't give all of my fellow believers the space for God to mold if I'm continually meeting my own needs by my own protective schemes. That's what's happening here. They're not giving God space. But of course, God is going to do something about that anyway. So what we have here is a failure of trustworthiness. They both fail at being trustworthy for the other. And it affects their behavior, and in so, it impacts others, right? It's going to impact Hagar and Ishmael. So there's big impacts for that. And it's the opposite impact that God has actually designed them for. So God not only then provokes their fear, he exposes the emptiness of their self-protection. He exposes their scheme as being not very effective. First, it's a false reality. they need to recognize that their actions are actually a lack of trust. They need to recognize that. He has to expose their actions come from disordered fear, and that those fears and those protective schemes will always pull away from God. And when you pull away from God, you always pull away from one another. And that you're pulling toward culture. So you pull away from something, you're always pulling toward another. The plan that works, though, doesn't. It causes disruption in all of the relationships. And therefore, it's a failure to fulfill the covenant vocation that they've been given. It is counterproductive to the bigger context. First of all, it causes Hagar to reveal her disordered character. So I remember speaking with somebody saying she always felt sorry for Hagar. But you need to read carefully. Hagar's not innocent here. Because Hagar's character comes out. It says she despises her mistress. Now, in that culture, as a servant, she was Sarai's servant. That was her job. That was her vocation, actually. And her vocation was, and she knew this, to be a surrogate. But now the word despise actually means to flaunt her betterness. To say, I'm better than you. I was able to get pregnant and you aren't. I'm so much better than you. So she puts herself on top of her mistress. It's not the order that is there at the time. It also causes Sarai to blame Abram. Well, we see this all the time, right? When you're in a trustworthy relationship and you aren't trustworthy, blame is always going to come out. But the interesting thing about Sarai's blaming of Abram, it's actually true. She blames Abram for not being trustworthy. And it's true. Abram's not trustworthy. It reveals that he isn't trustworthy. He would have been responsible for making sure that the surrogate does not take Sarai's place either in his affections or in her position. That was Abram's responsibility. And he has completely let that go. That Hagar felt she could actually flaunt her despising of Sarai. That's under Abraham. And Sarai then calls for God to make the judgment. Again, we see some of Sarai keeps on moving back and forth as to depending on God and not depending on God, which is how we all are, right? It's a beautiful, realistic picture. It also causes Abram to defer his responsibilities to Sarai. What does he say when Sarai says, what does he say to her?
You told me
what you want.
Do what you want, Sarai. Do what is right in your own eyes. And of course, if you know Judges, you're like, oh, no, don't do what's right in your own eyes. But here we have Abram completely abrogating his responsibilities. Now, I'm not going to do it. He should have. He should have been the one to say, Hagar, you can't do that. He lets Sarai do it, and he lets Sarai do it, which now brings out even more fear, and Sarai handles it with not a great character trait, right? She becomes very harsh with him, with her. And so it causes Sarai to push Hagar away by treating her harshly, affirming the fear of the other in Hagar. She does exactly opposite what God has called her and Abram to be. They're the ones to call others to trust the other, and Sarai has done just the opposite. And of course, it causes Hagar to run away from the one place she could have actually found reality. So, how does God, after he provokes fear, he offers belonging. He is going to overcome the obstacles of their self-protective plan. First of all, he's the one to reunite the family. He's the one to come to Hagar and call her to submission. Why does Hagar listen? First of all, Hagar doesn't know this God. Remember, Hagar's a pagan. She comes from Egypt. Where do you think she came from? How do you think they acquired her?
Maybe when he was in Egypt, the king gave him all kinds of stuff.
Yep, that's what, remember, it says the king gave them servants. This is where Hagar comes from. Hagar doesn't know this God. And here she's encountering a God. So she makes up a name for him. This is not an indication that she enters into a relationship with him. It's a practical action. She needs to know who this God is in case she ever wants to call on him again, right? remember, gods are territorial. She's run into the wilderness. Oh, and there is this god. Oh, I didn't know there was a god here. What's your name? Oh, okay, good. Good for me to know. Put it in my back pocket so I can call on you again if I'm ever in the wilderness, right? That's important, right? Because it tells us there's no relationship here. She's just aware that there is another god here. Okay. But she happens to be right in what she calls him, mm-hmm. right? She actually is right about his character, and it's his character that moves her to go back to Abram and Sarai. So, Hagar's submission, at least in the movement, happens because of God. It is because of Abraham, because of Abram, that Hagar will be blessed. God tells her she'll have many descendants, and it's those descendants that will care for her. So God is already assuring her, I am seeing to it. I am looking out for you. And you're going to have plenty of care. And your son also will be blessed. You are pregnant here with a son. You will be blessed. And one of the blessings is that your son will not have to live under the shadow of any brothers that might come along. Why is that a big deal? Well, because it fulfills the promise that he's going to make to Abraham soon. And he says to Abraham, you're going to be the father of many nations. Ishmael cannot be a separate nation if he stays in Abram's family. Oh, so that is part of a blessing that he's giving to Ishmael. And it does tell us that Ishmael will live east. So we know that Ishmael's choice will be to live away from God's order, away from the covenant. He'll carry on the defiant character of his mother. So we understand that Hagar, and we know this even as it comes further into the story, that Hagar never really submits to Sarai, nor does Ishmael. And so we see, remember we've always talked about shame responses being passed down, fear responses passing down. They're passed down to Ishmael here. So that the blessing is not because they submit, because they never do in their heart. The blessing is because they're connected to Abraham. And that was the covenant. I will bless anyone who is in your family, who actually is part of you. So Hagar and Ishmael are not excluded from blessings. They are excluded from the vocation of being blessing bearers. Deliverance, though, can only come for this whole family through submission. Hagar to submit to her mistress, Sarai and Abram to submit to one another, and to submit to one another together to the Lord. So what God does is he brings the family together, but he also promises more family. And now, of course, this comes 13 years later that he promises more. We're in 17 now. And God promises Abram, I'm going to give you more children, and they're going to be through Sarai. The next child I give you will be through Sarai. But here's the thing. For 13 years, Abram has believed that Ishmael is the promised son. Right. For 13 years.
Wow.
That's a long time, right? And so all of Abram's dreams and hopes for what God has promised him have been attached to Ishmael. He would not have been looking for another son. In fact, when God says, I'm going to give you a son through Sarah, the first thing it probably did was provoke his fear. What? Wait. What about Ishmael? Right? This is his son. That's the only son he has. So we have God saying, I'm going to give you more family, part of belonging. And then he's going to offer him partnership. He's not offered him partnership up till now. And now we have him say, Abram, walk before me. This is an invitation. This is God Almighty says to him, walk before me. The word walk before me actually means to walk before my face. Or in my presence. It is, walk with me. Think with me. So you can participate in my work with me. It is what we've been doing all last semester and this semester. It is the call to walk with God as partners. It is the next half of what God has been doing. Calling us into relationship, not merely for our benefit, but so that we can be partners with him. And he says, walk with me and be blameless. This has nothing to do with sin here. The word blameless actually means complete. And be complete. Because to participate in God's work as vice regents in secure community with regular mentoring and fellowship, that's what God created him to be. That's what he means. Be complete. It is in partnership with me that you are complete. You're not complete because you entered into relationship, but that you entered into a relationship and now are partnering with me. Which is not quite exactly how we present salvation, right? We always present salvation as a benefit rather than, no, this is actually a partnership that you're entering into. The covenant then has been a process of growing Abram and Sarai's relationship. They were promised relationship in Genesis 12. They ratified the relationship in 15. Yes, I want to be in the relationship. And now there is partnership in the relationship. Come and be with me in my work. Not just in my presence, but in my work. And so he says, if you accept this, then circumcise yourself and your family. This is the first time that Abram is actually asked to do something to signify his willingness to participate. It's been 25 years since the promise of the covenant, and this is the very first time Abram is asked to do something. Because it signifies a partnership, and in a partnership, the other has to do something. Not to get the covenant, but to say, yeah, I want to be a partner in the covenant relationship. And he says it's going to be an everlasting covenant. It's the first time he says this, everlasting covenant. It's not temporary. It's not a stopgap. It's not on a trial basis. Circumcision is a permanent mark because it's a permanent partnership. The permanence is in the sense that there isn't any other arrangement for the purpose that the covenant serves. And what purpose is the covenant? Covenant is always the mode of revelation of who God is. That's the purpose of the covenant, so that you will be the ones to reveal to the world. It doesn't mean that that purpose it serves will never be obsolete, but as long as that purpose is necessary, this covenant will last. It will be that. So, circumcision. Let's talk a little bit about that. In the A&E culture, it was actually a practice done in many of the other communities as well. It's not a new thing. But it was only done for two reasons in other cultures. It was either done as all rites of passage. It was either done as a rite of passage at puberty, which signified you are now entering into the adult community, which would have been 13. Or it was done at marriage, which signified you now belong to a new family. So it was either entering into adulthood or entering into a new family. This circumcision is unique in that world then because it was a ritual done for theological rite of passage. You are now entering into a new spiritual family. You've not been in a spiritual family before, right? They would never have thought that they could become part of the God's family, right? This is brand new, very unique, only to Israel. It marks them as belonging into a spiritual family, the family of God, a sign of participation and an indication that they will be continually committed to participating as partners. So God invites. He has Abram accept that invitation with circumcision. And now he says within this, I'm going to give you a new life. And I'm doing this by giving you new names. So the name changes are a big deal. Today in the paper, there was an article about how important names are even today for our identity, which I was surprised because I think most people think about names as just, oh, I like that name. Let's name that my child that. But it actually is a big identity thing even today. It was an interesting article. I don't have time to read it to you, but it actually does talk about identity. The first thing he does is when he changes their names is he detaches them from their former life. Both Sarai and Abram were derivatives of the moon god. They were derivatives of the names of the moon god, a pagan god. And so God needs to take them away from that attachment and give them a new name, which he gives them, Sarah and Abraham. So their original names signified an attachment to a pagan god, He takes that away. You're released from that former attachment. And now here's a new attachment. And because I'm the one naming you, your attachment is with me. Because whoever names signifies authority, right? Who names a child? The parents, right?
Oh, them too.
So God is considered here as the parent. I have authority to give you a new name and thus a new identity. I'm changing your character. Thus, you're becoming a new person. You're in a new family. You have a new identity. It's the reason Catholic confirmands took on new names, right? Do they still?
I think so.
Yeah, okay. I remember as a kid, I was so jealous of my Catholic friends.
Yeah.
You get to choose a new name?
Yeah.
It was so cool. And then I find, so that was just an added name, right? But then I found out that nuns actually completely changed their name.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I will tell you, from probably age 5 on, I wanted to be a nun. And that was one of those things. Wow, you have a whole new identity. I actually love the idea of what I thought a nun did, is just sat in her own home, prayed all the time, loved God. That was all they had to do. So this idea of name changes is actually was brought into the Christian world for a long time. I wish we still did that. I wish we did that in the world beyond confirmands, because we do have a whole new life and we do have a whole new identity now in Christ. So new attachment, new identity. A new name also is a sign of blessing and destiny. It kind of tells you where you're going. That's part of that. Your identity is going to be molded toward this name. You are now part of a new family in legal terms. So what it says is that our trust in God is that he can transform us into new people. Not that he can change our circumstances, but that he can change us. That's the idea of trust that we are talking about when we're talking about faith. We can be sure that he's going to break us and we're going to be in pieces, and he's not going to put the pieces back together like they were. He's actually going to use the broken pieces to make a new and better creation. I knew I didn't have time, but I wanted to bring up, I have a bowl that's made of broken pieces of that used to be really common, right? People would break dishes and then make them into another dish that's even more beautiful of all these broken pieces. That's what he's doing here. And he expands the promises for Abram and Sarah. So now I can call him Abraham and Sarah. Let's see if I stick with that. His original promise is you will be made into a great nation. Now he says you will be the father of many nations. And Ishmael will be the first extra nation. Abraham's identity goes beyond now just his physical life. He now will have an impact going forward into the future. So it expands the promise for who Abraham is and his impact. God basically reveals to both Hagar and to Abraham and Sarai and Sarah that he sees. And when we talk about he sees, so the word that Hagar uses, El Roy, the God who sees, doesn't just mean I see you, I've paid attention to you. It means I'm going to see to it that your needs are met. Mm-hmm. So that word is a bigger word here. We will use it with a different word as we come into 22. God desires a partnership. That's what we're learning here. He desires for us to walk with him, think with him, so that we're brought fully into his life and his work. Partner with me so you can partner with others. All right, opportunity 2. We go to Genesis 18. And I know I'm zipping through here, but I'm trying to get through them all. Again, we're going to start with provoking fear. And actually, at the very beginning here, it doesn't seem like fear is provoked, right? We have these three visitors. They come and visit Abraham and Sarah. And we don't know that Abraham or Sarah recognizes them as spiritual beings. We don't know. And there's lots of theological discussion over who were these people. We're not going to go into that. It's most important to know what they do is they serve them hospitality. And they do it as a team. So we're seeing here now Sarah and Abraham actually working together trustworthy of one another. So hospitality protocol in ancient Near East was when a visitor came. Remember, there's no hotels, there's no restaurants. So if you travel, you're dependent on strangers to help you out.
Wow.
So the protocol was, and still is in the Middle East, as my son was very much a receiver of that, when he walked into Syria from Turkey, he knew no one, didn't know how to get to anywhere and live, sat down on the curb, and out walks the man, says, "How can I help you?" I can find, and he found him a place to stay, because there aren't, you don't, you have to know someone to know where to stay in a place like that. So it still happens there. And so the protocol is, you would wash a stranger's feet who was traveling, you would offer them refreshment, and then you would feed them more than you would offer them. So it's a generous hospitality. But Abraham goes even beyond the protocol. He is extravagant with his generosity. So he, what we see here is that Abraham has learned to trust God. Remember how Abraham was stingy at the beginning, and now he's like, God is going to provide for me. I can easily not just give a little, but I can be extravagant. And how he's extravagant, we read it and say that's not a big deal. It is a huge deal what he gives. The amount of bread, the amount of flour that it says is used for the bread is enormous, enormous. It would have fed them for weeks. And he has Sarah make all of this bread. So here we know that Sarah is actually involved in the hospitality. And she makes a lot of bread. But then he also offers them meat. Now, meat isn't a normal part of their daily diet. Meat only comes out on special occasions. So this is extravagant. That would have been very expensive for him to use that. And we have no indication that either Abraham or Sarah are afraid. They're not, this is an other, but they're not afraid. So we're going, yay, Abraham and Sarah, you've really moved on here. But then we have the incident of Sarah, and we see her fear come out again. So the visitors sit down to dinner. Abraham is serving them. And the first thing they ask is,
"Where's your wife?
Where's Sarah?" Okay, two things, an echo. Where are you, Adam and Eve? Where is your brother, Cain? Oh, so the echo is meant to evoke an admission of fear, just like it was in Genesis 1, just like it was in Genesis 4, or Genesis 3 and 4. Abraham is serving the guests rather than Sarah. That is against protocol. Sarah should have been serving them, not Abraham. Custom would have had them do it. Where does he tell the visitors Sarah is?
In the tent.
In the tent. All right, there's only one reason to be in the tent. Yes, you read
the red tent. When I was pregnant.
Why?
It was delightful.
Why? Why does a woman stay in a tent during the meals?
It was her monthly.
She was menstruating, right? Mm-hmm. That would be why the woman would stay in the tent. Okay. Let's think. Sarah can't have children. She's not menstruating. She's beyond. Mm-hmm. And we know that Abraham asked her to bake bread. So obviously she wasn't menstruating, because if you were menstruating, you could not touch the food. You were unclean, right? Mm-hmm. So we know that she wasn't menstruating then. But her absence is noted at the serving of the meal, many, many hours after she's made the bread. It's very possible, something theologians believe, that actually her period has begun from the time she finished baking the bread to the serving of the meal, which would have been an immediate sign that her fertility had returned. And then the visitors make the announcement, Sarah will have a child within the year. So the tent is an intentional hiding, but it is an inconceivable possibility of fertility. Her hiding, tells us, is being told by her laughter. She's in the tent because she's bleeding. Sarah's laughter is one of incredulity. Absolutely no way. This is the indication of her fear. She's hiding it with a laughter of derision. this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
No way. And in fact, both Abram and Sarah laughed when they heard the pronouncement, right? Abram was told it before. He laughed. His laugh, though, is immediately followed by a statement that he accepts the news as true. Oh, all right. Well, what about Ishmael? Sarah denies that she laughs. Why?
She's afraid.
What is she afraid of? Humiliation again. This is Sarah's deepest fear always. Humiliation. Why humiliation? Because in the face of evidence that she's fertile, her fear is obscuring that reality. This can't possibly be what that is. I'm bleeding. It can't possibly be that I'm being fertile again. How is that? That doesn't work that way. And if I think that it is, I don't want to have that hope.
Oh,
no. Because if I hold on to that hope and it becomes not true, I'm humiliated all over again. I can't say, oh, I'm fertile again. No, because I'm going to be humiliated again if nothing comes of this. That's why she's afraid. She's afraid of humiliation. If she grabs onto this hope, for which she has been humiliated for too many numbers of years, and it turns out not to be true, it's going to be worse than it was in the beginning. The visitor's pronouncement that she is going to conceive just adds to that hope of which she is afraid. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Understand where she's at?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, how does God then offer belonging in the face of her fear being provoked? Immediately he says, is anything too hard for me?
Mm-hmm.
This is the revelation that he gives Sarah. The faithful one, he says, the one who has been already identified as faithful, as almighty, not only has the power to actually make you fruitful, but also has the power to protect you from humiliation and disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
I am not the God who humiliates or disappoints you. I will provoke those fears in you so you move closer to me and experience my faithfulness. Sarah, pay attention to my faithfulness and not your fear. Come to me. And he will give you the fruit of a trustworthy partnership. So God's revelation here is of partnering with Sarah. I'm going to show you I am a God who will not humiliate you. And then we have, almost so abruptly after that, we have this, Abram walks with the visitors to the edge of the mountain to look over Sodom. And we have a little preview then of what the partnership is going to look like. Remember, God's been calling Abram and Sarah to a partnership. He wants to first begin to mold them into a trustworthy partner of one another so that they can be trustworthy partners with God. And now he's giving them a preview of what that partnership is going to look like. And so he gives Abram the first taste of that. And he reveals his thinking to Abraham as they walk together. So Abraham can learn how to fulfill his vocation. He's going to be called to do righteousness and justice in order to bless the world. This is one of the ways he's going to reveal who God is, by doing righteousness and justice. His family will serve as a righteous minority, mitigating the destruction of the wicked world. So he's going to be the one to reveal God's mitigation. God allows Abraham to question him, not so that he can make sure God is doing it right, but he's actually mentoring Abraham. This is how it looks, how justice looks. And he's giving him a understanding of what that looks like. This is what justice looks like, he says. Justice responds to an outcry of oppression and violence. Justice responds by relieving that oppression and violence, by eliminating wickedness, by protecting righteousness. There's lots here. I'll just make one comment. I've always thought it was odd that Abraham ends his discussion with 10. Right? He says, what if 25 are found? What if 20 are found? What if, why does he end with 10? Remember that it's Moses writing this. So Moses kind of intercepts something, puts something in here that tells the audience, oh, we're talking, I see what we're talking about. 10, the number 10 for an Israelite community was the minimum number of Israelites that would you would have to have in order to have a synagogue in a city.
Oh, thank you.
And so basically what that says is 10 is the minimum number of faithful, righteous people that can actually make an impact on a community. If there's less than 10, it's more likely that the community will have an impact on the faithful. And so basically what he's talking about is there has to be a foundation of secure, trustworthy community in order for you to impact the community, in order for you to impact the world. So we're getting a little hint of this. And now we're going to show you what that looks like. We're going to give a contrast. So right now, of course, if that doesn't really apply to Abraham and Sarah right now because there's only two of them. And they're not Israelites yet. They're just Hebrews, right? Israelites come with his grandchild. So Moses puts that in there to give us a hint of what's really going on here. We're talking about the impact of God's people, but that it requires trustworthy community within first before they can go out. Otherwise, the impact is minimal or negligent. And then we have this Sodom and Gomorrah story. That's the contrast to Abraham and Sarah's visitations with the visitors. And it shows you how different it is when there isn't a trustworthy partnership. So the story is going to incorporate almost all of the same elements as Abraham and Sarah's visit, but completely different outcome. Yeah, you usually don't do that, right? You think of them as separate stories. They're completely there together, so you can see them as the contrast. Mm-hmm. It's intended to compare Sarah and Abraham's visitation so that we understand the one missing element in the Sodom story is an essential piece to the story. So, provoking fear. God provokes Lot's fear. Now, offering hospitality would have been expected of anyone in the Middle East, right? As the visitors come into his city, into Sodom, not just the leaders. And we know that Lot is a leader because he's sitting in the gate. The purpose of hospitality was always to turn a stranger into a guest, turn an other into us. But Lot is fearful, and he's fearful, even as a leader of the city, that these visitors are going to be harmed and that he'll be responsible for not protecting them. What he knows is that he lives in a society that has a paradigm of fear that pervades the entire community. He knows what the community is like. They will take what they want by force, which indicates that the community is self-focused, because a self-focus always leads to fear. And the fear is the fear of the other. And it escalates to violence, which is always where it leads when it's not addressed. Lot himself, even though he's a leader of the community, is considered an other, right? He's an alien, even though he's part of the community and a leader. And therefore, they don't partner with him. The men of the city don't partner with Lot because he is other. And they are so fearful in this city that they only partner with those who are like us. And so the behavior here is self-evident. It's unambiguous, and it's a violent demand to indulge their lust. And their lust, their desire, is an avoidance of other. They want to be in trustworthy relationship, but they don't want to do it with the other. So they protect themselves by partnering only with those like them, and forcing others to do the same. Because for you to do the same, to be like us, makes us feel safe. So when I force you to do what I do, it makes me feel safe, right? It's all about what trust is and about being with others. So that's what's going on here in this community. And so we have the hospitality that Lot offers, paralleling with the hospitality that Abraham offers. He gives them a feast. He doesn't just give them bread and water, he gives them a feast. He bakes unleavened bread with them. But here's the missing element. Who does that? Who bakes the bread here? Who's baking the bread here? Lot is. Who baked the bread was Abraham?
Sarah
did.
He doesn't have a partner.
Ah, he doesn't have a trustworthy partner, does he? No one, his wife, does not come and partner with him in this risky event, right? So there's no trustworthiness within the partnership. His fear is realized despite his protective plan, and the men come to the door looking for the visitors, and he pleads for justice with them. And now I know that we all hate this, just like we do in Judges, the same kind of thing. He offers his daughters to them. So let's pull back a little. We do the same kind of thing. It is what he's doing. He's saying, you wouldn't treat a citizen's daughters like this. So these are my guests. So they're just like my family. Don't treat them like that. It's a sarcastic statement. It isn't truly an offering of his daughters. It's a sarcastic statement. It's like saying a company charges you an exorbitant fee for being late on your bill. And you say something like, well, why don't you just take the clothes off my children's back? Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean?
No.
Do you want them to come and take?
No.
Okay. That's the way Lot's talking here. Does that help you a little bit with Lot?
Yeah.
Right? Like, what?
Sarcasm. I don't find a lot of sarcasm in the Bible. Though.
Oh, but there is a lot.
I can't have my guests to my
daughter. Yeah, exactly. So that's not what he's saying. He's basically pleading for justice. Wait a second. That's not a just thing. Is that just for you to exorbitantly pay, get money from me just because I was 2 days late? Well, how ridiculous. That's like taking the clothes off my... Same kind of thing. That's what Lot's doing here. But the provocation does just the opposite, right? It provokes their fears, and it creates even more disdain for someone who is so different than them. You are so other, we can't do... We don't want to... at all partner with you. No, we're actually going to do the opposite, and we'll threaten violence against you. So the fact is, Lot has very little impact on his community. Though he's a leader in the community, he sits in the gates, and though he trusts the Lord's order, this isn't good order, he is not received by the community. Though he's called righteous Lot in 2 Peter, which means he has trusted the Lord to some extent, yet he has no ability to sway the mob's action. Though he is the future father-in-law to the sons-in-law to be, when he goes to them, and he has the ability, because he's the future father-in-law, to void their marriage contracts, he has no sway with his sons-in-laws to cause them to pay attention. And in fact, the sons-in-laws think he's joking. And the word that's used here is the same word that's used when Sarah laughs derisively. The exact same word. They laugh and say, how ridiculous. Covering fear, but again, not swayed by their father-in-law, who actually has their whole life in his hands. Lot's independent righteousness did not result in an impact on society. And that should speak loudly to us. We cannot be independently righteous without partnering with one another and have an impact on society.
Mm-hmm. Me and Jesus sitting in the corner.
Absolutely. It cannot happen because we aren't modeling being in a trustworthy relationship where I have someone's back even if they fail me. That foundation is what speaks. God offers belonging. He offers to protect Lot. And he says, I'm not going to destroy the city until you arrive safely at the little city that you've chosen. Note, though, that Lot's character doesn't mature. It never matures beyond trust. And this is why we understand Lot to not actually have been partnering in covenant. He's grateful for the rescue, but he's still fearful. God says, I'm going to rescue you. Go to the mountains. And he says, oh, no, I can't possibly go up to the mountains. Let me go to this little city here. It's nothing.
Negotiating with God.
Right. He's telling God what God should do. And God is gracious enough to say, all right, I know you're fearful. I'm going to give you that. You can go there. And yet later, he moves to the mountains because he's afraid. The protection is offered, though, because God remembered Abraham, not because Lot was actually in partnership with him. Lot is connected to Abraham, and so the effect of the covenant is that Lot, who now represents the nations, and will in this passage, actually is blessed because of their connection with Abraham. So the Lord protects Lot, but the Lord also warns Lot and his family, don't look back. The prohibition here is not concerning looking on the destruction. Because remember, it doesn't get destroyed until they're safe. Mm-hmm. So it's not, don't look at all that destruction.
Oh.
The actual warning is, don't keep your attention on what you're leaving. Don't focus on what you've left. In actuality, it's not just my eyes, but don't go back there. Don't return. Don't be so attached that you return there. It says, the wife was behind Lot. She should have been with Lot, but she was behind, which already tells you she's reluctant to leave. And then it says she looks back. It doesn't mean she just glanced. It actually means she turned around. She abandons the flight and most likely returns all the way to Sodom. Why can we say that from this passage? Well, because Luke actually affirms that. Luke says, and he's warning about on the day to come, on that day, no one should go back for anything. Remember Lot's wife.
Oh,
that's what Luke says.
Lot's wife might have been a native of Sodom. I mean, he wasn't married when he came.
Yes, and she probably was.
So she probably was.
Exactly. So she probably was, and she does go back. Mm-hmm. Luke tells us that's what she does. So she goes back, and then it says she's turned into a pillar of salt. Now let's pull away from that a little bit. It's not this magical, all of a sudden she turns into a pillar of salt.
And the coloring pages to prove it, too.
Yes. So the destruction that is rained down on Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around is sulfur and fire that rained down on the cities. Now, we need to understand the geography of that area. We already know, because they already told us when Abraham was rescuing Lot, that this is a place that has many tar pits, right? So there's these tar deposits and sulfur deposits all over the land, is all over there, as well as the ubiquitous mineral salts that are there. And everyone knows that, right? All the mineral salts that are in the Dead Sea and around. And the mineral salts are made up of this. So listen to this, especially if you were a scientist when you were a little kid. Sodium, potash, magnesium, calcium chloride, and bromide. If you put those together as a little kid in an experiment, and I know most of us aren't guys here, but I know that my husband did this. You put all those together in a science experiment, what happens?
The stuff that erupts like a volcano?
Yes, yeah. That's exactly what it is. It's when you make those volcanoes, it comes out. That land has all of the ingredients. All it needs is one spark. And an earthquake could have done that. Mm-hmm. It would have sparked all of those chemicals and done exactly that. It would have spewed out all of that mineral salts, covered everything.
Say them again. What were they?
Sodium, potash, magnesium, calcium chloride, and bromide. So, that's the idea of her turning into a pillar of salt.
Interesting.
So, the problem is Lot's fears continue. Even in the face of God's call to belonging to through protection, after the destruction, he runs to the mountains, where he didn't want to go in the first place. He fears that the city that he's in is going to be caught in the destruction as well. But the visitors had told him, no, run to that city and you will be protected there. Mm-hmm. He does not trust. He has such little trust in the Lord. And his fear that has been provoked and probably throughout his entire life living in Sodom is handed down to his daughters. Mm-hmm. His daughters are fearful. That they look around at the destruction and say, it looks like the whole world is gone. We'll never have children. And so by their fear, they move toward what they are familiar with. Not an other. I don't want to go back to where Uncle Abraham is. I will go toward what is not other. And so, interesting, they're caught in the same type of atmosphere that Ham was caught in. New world, there's no one around. Got to populate, might as well use a parent. That's where we have Lot's daughters. And of course, it produces children, does what they want. But those children end up being the Moabites and the Ammonites, who live east of Jordan, farther away from God's presence, and therefore often enemies with Israel. So Lot not only has no impact on his community, he has no impact on his family. Lot's wife looking back, turning back to Sodom, means she rejects not only Lot, but her daughters. That's how much her attachment was to the place where you only are with those who are like you. She was going back to that, to those who are like me. That's how much her pull with her attachment was, and how little pull of attachment she had with her husband. There was no trustworthiness in that partnership. And no impact with his own daughters, who are fearful enough to have the fruit of that fear. And that is Moab and Ben-Ami. So the daughters are put in a position of fear. They had no parenting that showed them a trustworthy community, a secure community, and so they are going to produce the same kinds of things. All right, Genesis 20, where are we? Okay, Gerar. Now we have, we are going to go over a little. We'll go through 21. We have them in Gerar. Now we have the same situation that we had way beyond, but we have to understand it's a different context. So last time that Abraham and Sarah employed this lying trick they have, it was when they were traveling to Egypt, outside Canaan. It was distrust that led them there. They didn't think God could provide for them. This time they're inside Canaan. They're not outside. They're inside. They're actually traveling is part of his job, his wandering shepherd lifestyle. He is actually settled in between Kadesh and Shur, and he's just pasturing his flock. He's just gone to Gerar to find more. So he's not in a distrustful position. So why does he do the same thing? Well, just like we do the same thing, it's habitual for him. What we find out in verse 13 of 20 is that it's a regular practice. Before they even came into Canaan, that was their agreement. Anytime we meet others, we will say, "You are my sister." So despite the activity having caused some problems before, and despite God having to rescue him from that, they haven't completely had all their fears transformed to trust. Just like us, we often compartmentalize God's presence and work in our lives so that we don't transfer it to other situations, right? Oh, God protected me here and saved me here, showing me that my schemes don't work. But we just use that as one incident. And then we go on to the next thing. We do the exact same thing, right? Don't we do that? Same thing with Abraham. And again, Abraham's story is wonderful because we see us, right? It's not like he goes from fear to trust and that's it. No, he goes from fear to trust and a little bit down from fear and then trust and fear. But he is progressing farther and farther toward trustworthiness. But there are going to be dips, just as there are for us. What is he afraid of? He's afraid of the other. Abimelech asks him, "What have you seen that you would do this?" And again, echoes of, "What have you done?" Mm-hmm. "What have you seen?" And Abraham says, "I didn't think there would be any fear of God in this place." Hmm. What Abraham does is again assume, because you're other, you can't possibly then understand who I am and or you can't understand who my God is. When Abraham, and then, so then I'll act like you. I will act the same way the world does. I'm not going to show you anything different. When Abraham acts like the world does, making his own protective plans, right? We all do. Against the other, he brings destruction to the other. And so his assumption that there can't possibly be fear of God in this place is to say, you're so other, you can't possibly understand me, so I'm just going to act like you so that you can understand me a little bit. Which is actually the excuse we use, right? Well, we've got to, I remember someone saying, you know, I've got to go to, you know, all these parties and bars and get drunk because, you know, they will think that, you know, I'm not one of them. Yeah, the whole point is to show you're trustworthy even though you're other. Abraham doesn't do that here. It provokes fear in Abimelech when it's found out what has happened, that Sarah is his wife. Abraham and Sarah's protective plan are discovered, and it provokes his fears because in the Aini culture, adultery was the great sin. And it has been the great sin most of history until our modern times. Why? Because it is characteristic of anarchy. It actually overthrows order. And order is necessary for society to survive. And thus, it's very detrimental to society. So Aianese didn't like that. Abimelech sees the unseen reality better than Abraham does. So the results of Abraham and Sarah's protective plans affects Abimelech and his family. They're struck with this plague that has to do with sexual dysfunction. We know that because it isn't just the women's ability to have children that are affected, it's Abimelech, because Abimelech has to be healed as well, which means that most likely the plague had something to do with Abimelech becoming impotent. So Abimelech is not able to have any sexual intercourse, making conception impossible for the wives. But in that, it also actually protects Sarah from having any sexual contact with Abimelech. Why is that important? Because what were they just told back home? You're going to have a child within the year.
Oh, right.
And if you have sex with someone else,
it might be
there. Yes. And so God has to protect Sarah here because he's protecting Abraham's heir, right? So belonging is offered by God's protecting them. He overcomes Abraham and Sarah's plan. He reveals reality to a pagan king. He gives protection from the anger from that pagan king, and he protects Sarah's and eventually Isaac's paternity. But he also offers partnership from a very strange place. This is one of those, wow, God, you can show me the reality when from a place I can't even imagine. Abimelech, the pagan king, is the one who unexpectedly offers a trustworthy partnership to Abraham. He says, as after he's healed, Abraham, you can have full use of the land. You no longer have to fear anyone in all of the areas belonging to me. You don't have to fear anymore. We're in partnership now. You can use my land. I'm not going to take anything from you. Which reveals Abraham's faulty thinking. There is fear of God in this place. Just because someone may not have a relationship with Yahweh does not mean there's no recognition of his power. So Abimelech offers a partnership, a trustworthy partnership with Abraham, but he also offers it to Sarah. He does it to Sarah by giving her a generous offering, 1,000 pieces of silver. This is a vindication for her. First of all, the 1,000 pieces of silver is the typical price, the typical bride price among the gods. So it's more than a common worker's lifetime wages. Wow. What it does is it honors Sarah as a princess, as on the same level as a god. Basically, he's saying, we're in partnership here. You do not have to fear humiliation from anyone. Because what I just gave you was to say, you are a princess. You are not to be humiliated or talked about. You are a princess. So Abimelech, the pagan, is the one who offers a trustworthy relationship with Abraham and with Sarah. And we'll see it actually go beyond that as we go in. Farther into the stories. Abimelech is unwittingly serving as a model of partnership. He doesn't realize it because his reason for doing it is appeasing this powerful God of Abram, of Abraham. But what Abraham and Sarah can see is, oh, when we're partners with God, we don't have to fear the other. The other should not fear us to partner with anyone because we're partners with God. And so by God's direction, Abraham partners with Abraham and prays for his healing, and his whole household is healed. Opportunity 4, Isaac comes on the scene, Genesis 21. Finally, we have the promise fulfilled and Isaac is born. We have this, we've been awaiting for it, right? Ever since Genesis 12, we've been waiting for this. And yet the funny thing is, it's reported so briefly without any fanfare. It's like, oh yeah, Isaac was born, let's go on. What do you think the author's doing here? I think two things. One, I think he wants to say, don't be surprised that God fulfills his promises. Mm-hmm. He's going to fulfill them. So yes. But also, I think he's saying, it's just because I fulfilled the promises doesn't mean that my work is done. Mm-hmm. I still have work to do. My partners still need a lot of molding. So his faithfulness is on display, and they name Isaac Laughter. And it says, Sarah's initial laughter of derision, hiding self because of fear, has now turned into a laughter of joy that is shared with all. It's completely turned around. Sarah has completely turned around. Her fear into trust, her trust into trustworthy partnership, and now a trustworthy partnership where she wants to share that. But again, Sarah's fears get provoked. Not surprising, as with us. Her fear gets provoked when she finds Ishmael. I don't know what it says in your Bible that he says, but the word is laugh. Again, we have laughter throughout. But Ishmael's laugh is the same laugh as Sarah's original. And as Lot's sons-in-law, it is the laughing of derision. He's mocking Isaac. He's doing exactly what his mother did to Sarah. Huh, I'm the firstborn. I don't know what big deal Isaac could be. I'm the firstborn. I'm the heir. Sarah fears now that Ishmael will take the place that God has promised Isaac. By biology and cultural practice, Ishmael is the heir. So Sarah desires to send him away. It speaks, first of all, to her understanding of her husband. She understands that Abraham's attachment to Ishmael is not healthy. It's beyond a father's attachment to the son. It's a disordered attachment that is blinding him to God's work. Is there possibly some jealousy on Sarah's part? Yeah. Possibly. But we can't say because the text doesn't tell us that. We do know God never chides her for it. But he does direct Abraham to do exactly what Sarah says. So Sarah is right in that Abraham's attachment is going to blind him from God's work. Abraham is fearful as well. His son, whom he's assumed for 13 years, is the promised heir. He's afraid that his son is not going to be cared for now. That he's not going to be an heir with Isaac. He thought maybe both of them could be heirs. His picture is being completely disrupted. But Abram's fear is quickly allayed, which means he's fearful and he turns right to God. His disordered fear has turned to ordered fear. Yes, we're still going to be fearful, but when we turn immediately to God, our fear has become ordered and good. It pulls us to, and that's what's happening here with Abram. It does also provoke, of course, Hagar's fear. She fears that her son is going to die in the wilderness, and it causes her to cry out. Here's the point. Remember, she named that God who was in the wilderness so she could cry out again to him? She doesn't. She just cries out. She had a name for a God who protected her once, and she doesn't cry out to him. Now, of course, it's the same God that does answer and shows her that he's providing for her, gives her water, but she has no relationship with him. She has forgotten all about him and doesn't even bring to mind that she's in the same position. So, how does God offer belonging? He reveals reality. to both Abraham and Sarah. Yes, Isaac will be the one through whom your descendants will be named, and also to Hagar. And he offers comfort in that. He says, look, Abraham, Ishmael's going to be well taken care of. And he tells this to Hagar as well. I'm going to take care of him. I'm actually going to make him into a great nation. That's better than you could do, Abraham. You couldn't do that. And Hagar, you couldn't do that. I will do that. It enables Abraham to let go of his son without even provision. He gives only food and bread, right? And that's it. He gives him nothing else.
No money.
Why is he able to do that?
He trusts God.
Because he trusts God completely. God has told him, do exactly what Sarah has said. And so he can do that. It indicates a great trust of God's protective care. It also enables Hagar to see reality. Water's provided, but Hagar doesn't have any relationship with Yahweh here. And she actually not only raises her child outside of Abraham's family, but she returns to Egypt to get him a wife, which means she returns to the paradigm of life that she knew. And so does Ishmael. So they are, again, with the Egyptian paradigm. Even though she encountered Yahweh, she doesn't call on him, and so she returns to her former life. She turns backwards. She does exactly what Lot's wife did. So, Ishmael, though, will be blessed. He'll become another nation. He will become the father of the Ishmaelites. Now, I'm just going to really quick take a journey away from that a little bit. We need to understand Ishmaelites. Ishmaelites are not today's Muslims. Neither Muhammad nor the Quran ever claims that Muhammad was a descendant of Ishmael. Today's Muslims claim that they are spiritual sons of Ishmael. They are not descendants of Ishmael. I don't want to go into the whole thing of that, but they're not descendants of Ishmael. So when we talk about Ishmaelites, we're not talking about Muslims. Ishmael and his descendants aren't granted any land, nor do they become blessing bearers. They prosper only because they have a connection with Abraham. There is no conflict in the Bible whatsoever between Israel and Ishmaelites, ever. The conflict only comes in modern times when Islam becomes a religion in 610 AD. That's a modern religion. And only when it becomes a religion is there conflict. So, needed to do that so that we don't read things into there. Opportunity 5, we have the wells. We have Abimelech back in the picture. I love it. Abimelech offers a further partnership on the basis of Abraham's connection with this powerful God. But Abraham, by this time now, has been molded. His trust in God has provided, that God provides for him, has matured into being a trustworthy partner, not only with Sarah, but with others. He is no longer afraid of others. He is no longer afraid of Abimelech being another. So Abraham and Abimelech make an agreement to treat each other with kindness. Yeah, no problem. Let's enter this. Abraham's lack of fear and his ability to be trustworthy enables him to tell Abimelech the truth. Remember, that's one of the first signs of a trustworthiness. I can tell you the truth, even though it might disturb you a bit. Like, I can tell you this is not order. And so as soon as they make this agreement, Abraham says, hey, by the way, Abimelech, your servants have taken my well. Now, this is land, this is a well that he has dug in the land. It doesn't belong to Abraham, but the well belongs to Abraham because during the A&E times, squatters' rights were actually available to alien residents. They could dig a well on property that wasn't actually owned by anyone, and it could belong to them. So that was just a right in the A&E system. So the well belongs to Abraham, even though he doesn't own the land. Abimelech has jurisdiction over the land. He doesn't actually own it. It's not like his house property, but he has jurisdiction over it because he's the king of that place. So when Abimelech's servants take the well, when they seize the well, they're taking what belongs rightfully to Abraham. But Abraham has no qualms about telling the truth. They took the well, it belongs to me. So because of his trustworthy partnership, where he tells the truth, they're able to seal the agreement with a covenant. And Abraham gives Abimelech 7 ewes. And he says, this is a testimony to remember, this well is mine. It actually parallels when Abimelech gave Sarah the 1,000 pieces of silver to say, Sarah, that Sarah's yours. So he gives the 7 ewes, this is mine. We have an agreement here, and now we can work together. So what's the belonging God offers here? He has now given space that's expanded for revelation, for their vocation. Abraham's mature character has been molded by God for the years, over the years. It's caused him now to formalize and establish a working relationship with peoples of the land, with others, which expands the place where God's revelation of himself through Abraham's family can readily be seen. Because they're going to have continual dealings with one another, and without fear, no longer will God's work in their lives be obscured. So Abraham then, his understanding of God has expanded. So he worships there. He plants a tamarisk tree, which would have been the equivalent of an altar in a place that has stones. Remember, he's kind of in a pasture land that has a lot of stones. And he calls on the name of the Lord, where he proclaims that his understanding is that God is the everlasting God, El Olam. The everlasting God doesn't reference his age or his length of time of existence. It actually talks about him holding history, all of history, history for the nations and history actually for Israel, for the destiny of Israel, that God is actually El Olam. And so what we have here as we go into 22 for next week, we have God molding Abraham and Sarah from fear to trust to being trustworthy in partnership. Trustworthy in partnership in their marriage, which gives them a basis then to be trustworthy with others, countrymen, right? So that they can have an impact on the world. That's why the Sodom and Gomorrah story is so important, that we understand the contrast of not coming from a secure relationship where there's trustworthiness. You have nothing, no foundation from which to give to the world who are others. That's what the whole thing is supposed to be. God is transforming Abraham and Sarah into being trustworthy. And so we have trusting God, yes, but then living that is being trustworthy with the other. And so next week we will go into the sacrifice of Isaac and then into Isaac's story. So may the God of peace equip you in every good thing to do his will, working in us that which is pleasing in his sight, through Jesus Christ, to whom be the glory forever and ever. Amen. Amen.
Wow. Brought a lot of clarity.
Mm-hmm. It does, doesn't it? It really helps you understand what's going on there, rather than these
stories
that are not connected.
They're crazy stories.
They're crazy stories.
Yeah. And they had their But that makes a heck of a lot more sense.
Because we all probably knew Lot's wife story. We all did that pillow of salt thing.
Right.
But we all thought it was because she didn't do what she was supposed to.
This.
God told you don't turn around, you turned around. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Okay.
Okay. And so I put it like that, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think up here seemed to work better.
Mm-hmm. Discussion. What are we calling it?
I'm just a little curious about the culture of the time, though, when you're talking about, you know, that they were, like, wanting to sleep with the other men, and then the...
that's normal.
That's normal for back then.
It wasn't. Yes. No, it wasn't normal. In fact, that's why there's not a lot of commentary on it, because everyone would go, oh, they're so fearful. It is a... an indication of how fear builds up so much. Mm-hmm. The more fear builds up, the more we go to our own little enclaves, right? Mm-hmm. Think about today. What does today look like? Yeah. We're all in our little, like,
pockets of people.
And there become these pockets of people that are feeding one another about us.
Yeah.
It's us. So it's just an indication. Paul does the same thing. That's why he uses that sin to say that's just showing you what happens when you're so fearful, you don't run to God. Mm-hmm. You actually create a community of people who are like you rather than others, mm-hmm. which is the total opposite
right.
of what
right.
God has called us, right? Right? Mm-hmm. So are we on?
Yes, we're on.
Okay, so discussion about this. Let's ask questions, comments about... So we basically did 16 through 21.
Mine's just in the beginning.
Yeah.
With Abram and Sarai. So you're saying, you know, like she has not given him a child. So how come, like, and he doesn't know. He didn't know God before God revealed himself to him. So how come Abram stayed with Sarai so long?
So the only way I can answer that, and I've thought about that too, like, was Abraham just naturally that? Probably not. None of us are. But remember how God protects Abram in so many odd ways, like protects her from having sex with Abimelech by having Abimelech be impotent, basically? Mm-hmm. You don't think God was doing that before he even called them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. So that is my only answer. God doesn't just show up on the scene when he calls Abram. He's already been working. We don't get that in the text, but that would be the best, I think, address of that. Mm-hmm. All right, what other questions do we have about this section? When we make protective plans, mm-hmm. it actually brings destruction to others. Mm-hmm. So our protective plans, as always, affect other people, right? Mm-hmm. So Sarah's first plan is, right, to use Hagar.
Okay.
But exactly that, she's using Hagar. So it's always going to make, my protective plan is always going to make pushing away from someone else, right?
Okay.
And since what we're called to do is call others, the mm-hmm. other, mm-hmm. closer, it's always going to be destructive. Anytime you push someone away. And when I'm making a protective plan, it's always going to push someone away. Adam and Eve, they decided to protect themselves with leaves. It pushed each other away from one another. Mm-hmm. And then they started blaming one another, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to play devil's advocate.
Yeah,
please. Because I'm my father. Couldn't Sarah think, or Sarai, think, hey, this is what's supposed to happen. Can I call you to help me make this plan happen by you being the pregnant person?
You mean, so help, you mean bring Hagar into the plan?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what Romans 1 tells us, right? We make our evil plans, and then we draw others into it. That's worse.
Okay.
So that would have been worse, right? And it wouldn't, think about this. Think about it in your own life. If you, even if you're in that culture and you say, my husband, we don't have children. I'm going to bring another wife into the plot. Mm-hmm. Well, if I cozy up to this wife, things will be good. You're a woman.
It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
We got a reality show about it too.
Yeah, right. It's not going to happen because that's not how God designed us.
Okay.
So it's against God's order.
Okay.
And again, we will see. I don't think we ever have a time when there are more than one wife that there isn't problems throughout the scripture, right? But we know that as women.
Right.
We absolutely know it. And the funny thing is, you sometimes even get that within families, right? Like between a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law. Mm-hmm. Which one is the most important woman in the, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's just part of who we are.
Here. Sorry, Lisa, I can't stay.
What else?
Oh,
honestly, a lot of the questions that I had you cleared up in your lesson today. So
once you begin to understand that it is all one story, it clears up any time that you're going, oh, that was weird, or I don't get that. Well, it's just how God does it. But when you see it as one story and that God's actually working towards something, it helps, right? It helps to actually see what's going on here. Also, I think one of the things that I think we've learned more than anything is we have to know our scripture well enough to know when there are echoes, so it tells us, oh yeah, this isn't trusting. It's the same wording. Those echoes always give us indication of really what's going on if we don't get it just by reading the story. So again, reading the context, reading it as one thread rather than... And you know, when I look at it, I go, oh, we're going to talk about seven individual incidents? But we would never say that about our life, right? Mm-hmm. Our life is one life.
Right.
It's not seven different lives. Mm-hmm. And it all actually goes together. Several years ago in study, we did... I can't remember what it was called. We did a timeline of our lives. Mm-hmm. And we saw, Chris, you were the one, right, who you said, I don't want to do this. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, you got to see where God had been working for the same thing all throughout. Oh, to see that God has actually been working the whole time in times I would never have thought that God was working until I actually step back and look at it as one big whole.
Which is why you have us walk and ask.
Yes, it is. I think that's necessary for us to understand, particularly this lesson and next lesson as we finish up. The idea that God wants us to be partners with him, that's a huge thing. Unfortunately, we have too often used the gospel as a God wants to save you, and it's just about getting a benefit. And that's what, I mean, next thing about Isaac's sacrifice is all about that. Is that what salvation is? Is it a benefit? It's actually not. God wants to partner with you. He wants to be in relationship with you because you're his vice regents. And he wants you to actually work with him. Not just, you know, as a kid, I mean, it was all I heard of. So I grew up on the South Side of Chicago, and there was a big, big church at that time that used to send out kids. Everybody knew it. We ran away at some point. We'd see two people coming, and they would always have long skirts and long hair. And they'd come, and they'd say, the question always was, do you know where you're going when you die?
Yeah. You die tomorrow.
If you die tomorrow, do you know where you're going? Mm-hmm. It was always the question. Mm-hmm. As if that was the point of salvation. Mm-hmm. The benefit. Right? Mm-hmm. And that always pricked your fears.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, do I know where I'm going?
Yeah.
That's the benefit. That's not what salvation is. So I think that's one of the things we need to see, that God's partnering with us is part of the package. And for us to live as if, oh, you know, God died for me, that's great. And not actually enter in like Abraham does into the partnership. Have we actually received that, what he wants to give us? The partnership is a big deal. And that's why this section is such a big deal. That we understand that that's part of what salvation is.
Isn't it fascinating then that one of the strongest Bible verses, John 3:16, mm-hmm. God's love the world, it ends with, you know, have everlasting life. Mm-hmm. That's what it presents. Not everlasting life. And while you're here,
and that's because we interpret the word everlasting life
for
wrong.
Later. Oh, it's, olam like starts now.
Current.
This is heaven.
El Olam, the everlasting God, the God who controls history here. Mm-hmm. So that you would have life, his life. Everlasting life is his life.
Okay.
So we've completely changed the idea.
See, we need Jill just to interpret the whole
part. But it's true.
But it's
all wrong.
And that's why, though.
Yeah.
Because we don't use it. And that's why.
We use different words.
It's why I'm so adamant about knowing the Old Testament. Yeah. So that you understand what the New Testament is offering you. it's so disjointed from what God has actually been doing through his...
Because if you tell someone who's not a believer God sent his son for you, it really doesn't give me anything. It gives me
nothing. It doesn't.
I'm sorry.
No, it doesn't. And that's absolutely, and we have to be very honest about that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't. That's one of the reasons why God's partnering with us. The first thing he wants to mold in us is that we're trustworthy partners. Because that's what the world wants, right? What is the world's biggest need? What is our biggest need?
Belong.
To belong. And my trustworthiness offers belonging.
So can you speak to more about how marriage reflects that?
Mm-hmm.
And how the so that it reflects the function of a trustworthy
yes.
relationship?
So marriage is, first of all, between two others, right? The most other that you can get as a human being is a male and a female. Mm-hmm. I can never be a male, he can never be a female. Which means that I am actually trusting him not because he's like me. Mm-hmm. I'm actually trusting him that he is for the relationship mm-hmm. and not for a benefit from him. Same way, I'm going to be trustworthy because I'm for the relationship and not for the benefit I get from it. And because of that, I actually will have your back even when you fail me. So that failures in marriage are very important because it gives us the opportunity to actually show, all right, you failed me. I'm going to tell you the truth, you failed me. But I'm sticking with it. I'm still here. And I'm going to have your back. And I'm not going to make you pay for this. I'm not going to be different. I'm still going to be in this relationship. That idea is what every one of us really wants. Because here's the thing. Even Cindy and I are very alike. We have a lot of similarities. I can trust Cindy. But here's what I know. I know that I'm going to fail Cindy at some point. I need to know that she's still going to be trustworthy because I know I'm going to fail. I feel most belonging when I know that someone's going to be there even when I failed them. That is the biggest thing a human being can be given. That's what marriage does, right? That's the trustworthiness of a marriage relationship and why God uses that as the picture of our relationship with God. God says, and we see it over and over in Abraham and Sarah's life, right? I got your back. Yep, you didn't have mine here. You didn't trust me. You didn't tell people that I was a God worthy of trust, but I'm going to have your back here and here and here and here and over and over and over again, right? We have a whole testament of God continuing to have Israel's back. That's trustworthiness. And so our role, our vocation is to be able to show that. And it's very difficult for humans to show it to humans because I'm trustworthy with God. Well, how am I trustworthy with God? By being trustworthy with his community, first of all, his family. Being trustworthy with my husband, if I have one, within the church. That shows the world. And here's what I am sad about. How does the world look at the church today? Well, we haven't been very trustworthy with one another. Think about all the splits that we have. Think about the times when we are angry with one another within the church and we don't want to either work it out or say, yep, we don't agree here, we're going to still have one another's back. No, we actually talk against one another. Well, what does that say to the world?
I wouldn't want to join that.
Shoot, I don't want, that's not a place of belonging. They won't have my back if I don't agree with them.
Yes, I hear you.
That's the whole emphasis that we have here in Abraham and Sarah's molding into trustworthy partners. That's why, as much as, and again, remember I said at the beginning, we need to have a lot of compassion for all of us because we're all in this, right? We're all going to fail. Yes, some of us have been through divorces. Yes, some of us have been through separate things. That's difficult. But it is also why the church needs to maintain those orders, right? Because that's what shows the world what it is like to be accepted by the other. So we need to maintain marriage. We can be compassionate when divorce happens, but it doesn't say, yeah, you know what, divorce is fine. No, we have to say that is an order and we have failed here, but we still uphold that. So that's, these little stories here have so much more than just what's happening to Abram and Sarah and that they're weird things that don't happen to us. They're actually all have very much to do with what we're living our lives with.
Is that why churches have pockets of groups like AA or GA or divorce people?
What's GA?
Gamblers Anonymous.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, the church will is saying we are, you are belonging.
Yes.
Us.
I actually think that's a great thing for us to do, right? That we, I also think that, especially as I've gone through this pericopes here, I think the church can do more about partnering with others so that we shouldn't be afraid to partner with others. God is protecting us. It doesn't mean that we're watering down the gospel. We partner with others. So we one of the things, so my daughter worked for years for World Relief and then for Emmanuel House, and she saw many times people not wanting to partner with other groups because maybe they weren't Christian groups. And it disturbed her so much. Like, well, wait a second. No, we're supposed to be partnering with others.
Yeah.
It is. And it is to show we are trustworthy partners. We are, that is our goal. We're to how do you show you're a trustworthy partner if you're unwilling to partner with others? You only partner with people that are like you? No, it tells the world that you're not a safe place for others.
It happens with Young Life sometimes. It's just weird. Like, sometimes local churches will see Young Life as too much of an other or like a threat to their main groups or whatever, but it's like, oh gosh, you're just like missing the whole point.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, same thing here.
That's so true.
You know, that's funny because I remember even when I worked at a church, I had suggested all the equipment is expensive when you're doing, you know, bulletins and things like that. And I said, well, why don't we partner with the church on the block? They could have this expensive machine, we could have this, and we could partner. And they all looked at me like, are you nuts? No, we can't do that. And I didn't understand why not. Why couldn't you? Because they're not, that doesn't make any sense. Yes, so our denominations, all of that, right? And it's just spiraling. So that not just denominations now, but within churches, and you know, there are different peoples within the churches, and oh, we don't go with them, or we don't go with them, or whatever it is. So yes, in all of the situations, there's that possibility, which we should actually be working toward partnering with others.
And that's what I just thought was like such a beautiful and almost just radical theme about this all.
Yes.
I mean, it's so true, of course, like our fear of the other, but when you establish a trustworthiness, like, that's, yeah, obviously a beautiful representation of what God is asking us to do with Him and in the world, but it seems so foreign to us a lot of the time.
We're
so scary or so, like...
And it is scary,
this, like,
right?
Radical call to,
you
know, establish relationship with people, organizations, whatever that
whatever it is.
Other. Is it because we might think... Instead of us, that we might become more like their tendencies, you know.
Well, there's definitely a fear, right? But again, this is addressed in here. Well, you don't do it on your own; you do it together.
Ten.
So, and obviously, 10 is kind of an arbitrary number. It's just signifying you can't do it alone. Lot had no impact on his community or his family. And so many times, that doesn't mean there are people who either are not married and or are in a marriage that perhaps one isn't a believer or not. That doesn't mean that they can't have impact. It means they must partner with the church. The church together comes to the world.
not me individually. I am not the church. We are the church.
Right.
So, but we can't pretend we're on our own. When people say, oh, I have a relationship with God. I don't need to go to church. I don't need to belong to a community. Well, that is absolutely anti-biblical. The Bible is all over that. Nope, doesn't work. Didn't work in Abraham's time, and didn't work in Jesus' time. And it doesn't work today.
Well, the example is of the Trinity. It's so yes. in relationship right. with each other that
exactly.
we can't exist outside of...
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So,
fair
yes, exactly.